Welcome to another Radio Internet Story Exchange podcast. I'm The Rise host and producer, Kelia Ramirez. On November 20th, 2006, I spoke with Dale Allen Pfeiffer, who lives in the Appalachian region of Kentucky. Pfeiffer is editor and publisher of a website and newsletter called The Mountain Sentinel. He's also a novelist, but his latest work is nonfiction. It's a book called Eating Fossil Fuels, and it's published by New Society Press. In Eating Fossil Fuels, Pfeiffer relates the many reasons why industrial agriculture is not sustainable. He calls for agrarian reform based on local organic farming. We began the interview by talking about the book's title. Dale, your book is called Eating Fossil Fuels. What do you mean by that?
In modern agriculture, we have boosted our agricultural production through the use of fossil fuels, mainly as fertilizers and pesticides, but also in the mechanization, the industrialization of agriculture as well.
How deep into the food system are fossil fuels?
In the 1940s, but especially the 1950s and 1960s, we began discovering how to transform fossil fuels into fertilizers. We also began developing fossil fuel-based pesticides. And with the use of those fertilizers, we were able to grow food with a minimum of solar energy, but an extra input of fossil fuel energy. And through the use of the pesticides, we were able to grow large-scale crops and keep the pests down as well. So at the present time, it's figured that for each calorie of food that we consume, we are using from 7 to 10 calories of fossil fuels to grow that calorie of food.
Now, you flat out state in your book, Eating Fossil Fuels, that industrial agriculture is unsustainable. Is this the reason why? That use of 7 to 10 calories of external energy to produce one food calorie?
Well, that's part of it. It's unsustainable on just about every front. The way it exhausts the soil, the water resources, the way it pollutes the water resources, it is just plain unsustainable.
And how does globalization add to the unsustainability?
When globalization entered into the picture, we began shipping our food immense distances. Analysts have developed something called food miles to look at how far food travels. And it's just horrendous how far food travels. Well, you know, it travels all over the globe, and it does that by way of fossil fuels. You remember, maybe 20 years ago, possibly as little as 10 years ago, when you went to the grocery store, say in the middle of winter, at least around here, maybe it was different in California, but around here when you went into the grocery store in the middle of winter, you would not find watermelons, fresh corn, or a lot of different produce, and strawberries. And now you can purchase those things the year around, and that's because they're being shipped in from all over the world.
To what extent is the matter going to be made worse in terms of food security or lack thereof by peak oil?
Peak oil means that there will be less oil available for all uses, and agriculture is one of the major uses of petroleum. And to that extent, it is going to cut the amount of oil available for agriculture. Even beyond that is the damper it's going to put on the globalization of agriculture. It's basically going to cost more and more to buy your food in the supermarket. And in time, you may see less availability of those globalized foods that everybody has become so comfortable with.
Now, some people say that peak oil is a hoax perpetrated by the big oil companies to get people to accept higher prices. What convinces you that it's not a hoax?
I have looked at the science. You know, I have looked at the figures. I haven't heard any good arguments as to why oil will last indefinitely.
Now, your book, Eating Fossil Fuels, is basically a big call for agricultural reform. What kinds of agricultural reforms do you have in mind?
We need the relocalization of agriculture, and we need to turn from industrialized agriculture to organic agriculture, back to small-scale family farm-type operations, development of permaculture, urban agriculture. You know, there's a lot of different facets that can go into helping to solve the problem.
Now, you mentioned urban agriculture. As a person who grew up in New York City and has been living in the San Francisco Bay Area for a long time, I'm sitting here wondering, you know, there ain't much room to grow stuff. And some of those vacant plots I know you've mentioned in your book, well, they used to be gas stations and industrial parts of town where there were probably chemicals leaching into the soil. I don't know that I would want to eat anything grown in such a place. What do you recommend for urban agriculture?
Oh, there are a number of different possibilities. First, so far as those contaminated areas are concerned, there are ways to remediate them. And among the steps in remediation, first you plant a number of vegetable crops that tend to soak up whatever the pollutants are, and you simply get rid of those vegetable crops. It depends on what the pollutants are, too, because you know, sometimes the only thing you can do is basically remove the sediment and replace it. So it depends on the pollutants as well. But there are a number of steps that can be undertaken to return a portion of ground back to a healthy state so that you can grow food on it. Other areas would be rooftops, so long as the roofs are not too high up and so long as they are not too well shaded by surrounding buildings. Let's see, windowsill gardens can produce a surprising amount of food. There's a few books out there. I don't have a list in front of me right now, but there are a few books out there about how to grow food in a window box garden.
We have been covering the story of the organic garden in Los Angeles. It was 14 acres feeding 350 families. That's really just a drop in the bucket where LA is concerned, but it's still a good example of what could be done. And in fact, the land was sold out from under the farmers and they have been ejected. It seems to me that the government does have a role to play in agricultural reform in the United States. What do you think needs to be done in terms of government action?
Oh, boy. Where to start there?
Anywhere you'd like.
Okay. Well, before we will ever achieve any sort of government reform in agriculture, we need to change the way our government views corporate business and social services entirely. Let's face it, we live in a very fascistic government, you know, a government that is in bed with corporations and with industry. And at present, they are not going to favor any sort of agricultural reform that would benefit common folks.
What can the average person, the local activist, do to promote agrarian reform in their area?
Okay, well, there are a number of smaller activities. You know, of course, you can push for local ordinances. Of course, you need some training in litigation to do that sort of thing, and that's always a good place to start. Local ordinances are much easier to pass than federal or state laws.
And these local ordinances would do what?
You could pass ordinances requiring your municipality to buy any food that it needs to purchase from local farmers or organic farmers, or to seek those markets first and then buy from industrialized agricultural markets only if it can't find localized or organic food products. There are a number of other things you can do. You could start a community garden. Of course, after the example of what happened there in Los Angeles, you'd want to be very careful about the ownership of your community garden. Oh, you could start a Johnny Appleseed type operation by just going out and planting seeds wherever you can find a spot to plant them. One good vegetable that lends itself to that sort of thing is the Jerusalem artichoke. Once you get them in the ground, they're very hard to get rid of.
Zucchini can be like that, too.
Yes, it can. Let's see, another thing, start up a Food Not Bombs chapter to help feed the homeless in your region. And at the same time, you could take them out and show them, you know, what you've been growing locally, you know, your zucchini and your Jerusalem artichokes and your apples or whatever.
Introducing people to their food, which is something that you also mentioned in your book, seems to be an important issue. I remember, and I lived in Indiana for a while too, that people would say, I don't need the farmer, I get my food from the store. We still have that kind of consciousness in cities, don't we?
Oh, there's a lot of that all over the place. And yes, we're just completely out of touch with where our food comes from. And because of that, we don't know especially where our meats are being grown and what sort of condition they're being produced under. You know, we wind up with the horrendous industrial meat growing facilities that we now have, where animals are just shoved into little pens and mistreated. And generally, when you look at these facilities and look at the animals in them, you would not want to eat anything from that animal. It also, another problem that we have now is with our new organic standards, thanks to the federal government that they managed to push through even though nobody wanted them except industry. You know, they're now able to use various manures and whatnot, sewage, as a fertilizer that they would not have been able to use and certify organic before. And I fully believe that that is what is behind the lettuce and spinach scares that we've had recently.
The E. coli issue.
Yeah.
But don't you advocate, at least that's what I got from your book, the use of animal and even human manure in place of fossil fuel-based fertilizers?
Oh, yes, we'll have to do that. It's the only way you can make the system sustainable, because otherwise you are losing the nutrients. You've got to close the cycle. But you have to do it in a healthy manner. And the way that the industry wants to do it is not in a healthy manner. They don't want to make sure that these fertilizers are free of things like E. coli.
You say that sustainable agriculture that's not based on fossil fuels is going to require depopulation, not only in the U.S., but around the world. How much depopulation are you talking about, and in what time frame?
According to the studies, now I base this entirely upon scientific studies, the U.S. would have to lose about a third of its population in order to survive without fossil fuel-based agriculture. And the world would have to decline to a population of about 2 billion.
And we're at about, what, 6.5 billion now?
Yeah, a little closer to 7.
That's a lot.
Yes.
It's more than half, well more than half.
Now, that's a large cut there. As I said before, we do have time to do this. We're not talking about losing our fossil fuel supplies overnight like Cuba or North Korea did. We do have time, but we're going to have to wake up to this and begin realizing that, you know, we can't go on the way we are. I do believe that the major problem is not so much overpopulation as it is overconsumption.
You've been listening to Dale Allen Pfeiffer, author of the book Eating Fossil Fuels, which is published by New Society Press. The book includes an extensive list of organizations working on the issue of sustainable agriculture. These include Growing Power, an organization that supports local food banks and soup kitchens and involves inner-city youths in community garden projects. It's on the web at growingpower.org. Also listed is the Community Food Security Coalition, which is dedicated to building strong, sustainable local and regional food systems that ensure access to affordable, nutritious, and culturally appropriate food to all people at all times. The coalition is on the web at foodsecurity.org. And IFOAM, the International Federation of Organic Agriculture Movements. IFOAM is the worldwide umbrella organization for the organic movement. The federation is on the web at IFOAM, IFOAM.org. Dale Allen Pfeiffer's publication, The Mountain Sentinel, is online at mountainsentinel.com. And I'm Kelly Aromaris. My website is rise4news.net, and you can email me at kellia@rise4news.net. This has been a Radio Internet Story Exchange podcast. Thanks for listening.